This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues. You're invited to ask the doctors anything. The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions. Please hit share and join us live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at She's On Call, hashtag She's On Call. Please welcome our hosts.
Hello, I'm Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear, nose, and throat surgeon in New York and New Jersey and the daughter of an ear, nose, and throat surgeon who is 89 today. Happy birthday, Appa.
Yeah, happy birthday, Uncle. So great. You're not throwing me off today, though, but that was great. I love that. It's always nice to see, you know, there are great pictures of Suju and her dad, both at her inauguration as president of, I always mess it up. It's an otolaryngology.
The American Academy of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery. I know.
Right. A-A-O-H-N-S. I love it. You guys, so I'm Marina Kurian. I'm a general surgeon. I do minimally invasive surgery. I do medical weight loss and surgical weight loss in New York City. And we have a great show lined up for you today. We're going to talk all about the back, which is unfortunately something that we all have to deal with at some time or another. And so we're going to get some great information from our guests.
Yep. I don't think at a certain age, apparently the first thing we think about in the morning is how much our back hurts. So hopefully our guests, Dr. Kimberly Sackheim and Dr. Michael Smith, will help us navigate the issues with the back and how we can keep our backs healthy for as long as possible. Dr. Sackheim is a neurologist and spine rehab specialist with her own practice in New York City called Spine and Pain Total Care. And Dr. Michael Smith is a neurosurgeon with Rothman Orthopedic Institute in New York City, and he specializes in spine disorders.
And we're live on YouTube and Facebook and LinkedIn on Sri Srinivasan's LinkedIn page. And you know, if you guys are watching and you are like, oh my God, my cousin has a back issue, tag them, have them come and watch the show. And we'd love to get your questions as well. So we're really looking forward to it because I know this is something so important to everybody. But first, we're going to talk a little bit of the news. And today is actually Palm Sunday and Passover and Holi for everyone who's celebrating. But we want to get into a little bit of the about vaccines, so a little, and COVID. Last week we did not talk about COVID as much as we did about the vaccines, but we're going to start off with, I think, what's good news, and that is that the AstraZeneca vaccine is 76% effective at preventing COVID-19 symptoms, but more importantly, right? So there's a little back and forth because it once said 77 and then they were like re-included some other data and data points and now it's 76%. I think clinically it's very effective against getting symptoms and it's 100% effective, which is the important part. 100% effective, the AstraZeneca vaccine is against preventing severe disease.
So, yeah, and I think, you know, this adds to our armamentarium of different vaccines that are available. You know, as we mentioned, Marina, 130 countries still haven't even started vaccination. So the more vaccines we have that are effective, the more we can get to our new normal, which is hopefully a healthier normal than our previous normal. The cases are less than they were, but they are not gone. So worldwide, you can see that there was a huge peak a couple of months ago, but there's in fact a second little peak, which is not so little, that is going on now. And part of it is that people with the vaccines feel like maybe they can move about more, maybe they can congregate more. And there are new variants. And one of the positive things about the vaccines is that they seem to be quite effective against some of the variants. So there was a study looking at blood from patients who had been vaccinated with the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. And they showed, looking at all these variants, it's a sort of complicated slide, but you need the dashed line at the very, very low dashed line at about 40 to be effective against the vaccines. And this vaccine was effective against all those variants. So even though we have some scary variants around with easier transmission and maybe more severe disease, the vaccines and masking and physical distancing will really help.
Yeah, and we were saying it's up in Europe. It's up all over a little bit. Like, we were seeing a dip, as we said, and Germany apparently has shut down until Easter and is reinstituting some severe quarantine restrictions. And I think also Italy is as well. And it's just,
yeah, and we actually got some new data from Mexico. Eric Feigl-Ding, who was on our show a while ago, 11 shows ago, talks about suddenly Mexico, because they looked at the number of increased deaths compared to last year, compared to 2 years ago, let's say. So there's a huge number of cases of people who have died from COVID in Mexico, because it's very hard to test everybody, just like it's very hard to vaccinate still. So this disease is prevalent, and please be careful. Please just continue to follow the guidance, because we can get past this.
And get vaccinated if you can. It's been hard. I think, Suju, you and I both talked about this, like trying to get some of our younger staff to get the vaccine. They have some hesitancy despite us detailing the benefits of the vaccine. There's still some concern that it was created too fast. And I think something I tried to explain to them, which I felt like I reached a couple of them, was this new study on long haul symptoms. If we can pop up that slide, it basically shows us that, you know, 7 out of 10, which is 70% people hospitalized for COVID-19 have not fully recovered 5 months after discharge. And this was a UK-wide study, and they were able to get over 1,000 participants that were followed up 5 months after their initial infection. And only 29% said they felt fully recovered, and 90% said they had at least one persistent symptom, and most experiences an average of 9 ongoing symptoms, you know, which is a lot. And one other study had come out that said that people who had these long haul symptoms after they got vaccinated, some of their symptoms seem to have improved. Now, that's actually some good news. If you had this virus and you still have residual symptoms, that perhaps a vaccine and can jumpstart your immune system to combat why you have these symptoms, you know, anywhere from 5 to 9 months later.
And if you don't want to get the vaccine because it's the right thing to do, or because you don't want to get COVID, or because you don't want to get long haulers, maybe you just want a donut. So Krispy Kreme came up with a very fun, I think, PR campaign. If you go by with your fully filled out vaccination card, you can get a free donut every single day for a year. Now, as physicians, Marina and I do not advocate eating donuts every single day. And I have to say, I walked by a Krispy Kreme 4 times last week with my vaccination card at hand and did not stop in for a donut. Feeling very strong.
Well, we're all traveling with our vaccination cards, it seems, right? So I get you. I looked into this only because of what I do, weight loss. The Krispy Kreme is 120 calories, just letting everybody know, just in case.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, you know, once in a while.
Off of vaccines, you know, there was a recent news piece that came out where it's a horrific case of actually physician abuse of patients. And this came out of the University of Southern California. And they had a doctor who is the college clinic doctor, right? And for 30 years or something like that, some high rate, a high number of years, where he was seeing students that came in, taking photos of, you know, their private parts, and perhaps and also inappropriately touching them or doing exams, that he had been told he should have a woman or a nurse in the room, and the nurses would even complain to the administration that he would set it up so that they couldn't actually see what he was doing. And then finally, one staff member just went and made a rape complaint against him. And I think that they then, and not that she was raped, but she felt like something was going wrong. And I think, you know, kudos to her, for all of them, for stepping up, and shame on the university for not listening and taking this into account and considering that this was contemporaneous with the Nassar scandal as well. And this is a case of when physicians go bad, and I applaud the university for trying to make some recompense to the people who suffered at his hands and at their blindness to the problem.
Yeah, I agree with you, Marina. I think patients should always feel and know that they are being treated with the highest respect and the highest safety when they encounter the medical profession.
Well, after that sort of sad part, we're going to get some hopefully good news, how to help your back, right? And so we have two wonderful guests that we're excited to have join us. Dr. Kimberly Sackheim, again, she is a neurologist and a pain specialist, and is owner of Spine and Pain Total Care here in New York City, and does spine rehab. And Dr. Michael Smith, who's a neurosurgeon with Rothman Orthopedics, and he does spine as well. So there's orthospine, there's neurospine, and Dr. Michael Smith is neurospine, and we're so excited to have both of you join us.
Welcome to both of you. We're so happy to see you. I want to let people know we have people watching from all over. So Raghavan Krishnamacharya is watching, Miriam Berkeley is watching, and wishes my dad happy birthday, thank you. Susan Chapone is watching, Ellen Austin is watching and says happy holy and happy birthday. Lori Smith, Deirdre Gruen, Kelly Sector, Vasanthi Okuma, Catherine Galligan, Linda Lawrence, Sudha Parekh. A lot of people are watching us. And
you know what this means? This means so many people are like, let's get to the back. Let's
right. Because, oh my God, every day you're moving in a certain way. You worry if you sneeze, your back's going to go out. So maybe we'll start with understanding the spine a little bit. So maybe, Kimberly, do you mind talking to us about the anatomy of the spine? Like, what is it that we are feeling back there? Or what anatomical concepts are we looking at?
Sure. And thank you so much for having me here today, guys. So very exciting to talk about the back, because it really is important to know what's going on and how you can try to avoid issues or help issues that you have. In our spine, we have bony anatomy. And that entails a larger part, which is the vertebral body. And that has an opening that protects nerves and the spinal cord in our body. In the lower back, we don't have the spinal cord, but we have a lot of nerve roots. And in between each one of these vertebral bodies is a disc. And the disc is usually where the issues lie. When a disc pushes out posteriorly, which is towards your back, it can irritate the nerve roots. And the nerve roots in this picture, you can see, are the yellow parts. Those are the nerve roots that usually cause the pain that people call sciatica, or pain that goes down your leg.
Yeah, and so there's so much to look at there. The spinal cord is like protected and it's there in red, but that's the whole idea, that this bony, this bony structure is protecting all of our nerves, and it works great most of the time, but then age-related changes or injury. I love how Suju said, like, you don't want to turn the ray in the wrong way and throw out your back. That's actually happened to me. Like, you just reach down for something and you're like, oh no, I can't move right now. And you try to quell the panic because you know, okay, don't move too fast. And your family's looking, you're like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, just give a second. It's gonna, you know, and then you just sort of get up and I don't know, take some Advil or Motrin and it gets better. And then you don't go see the neurosurgeon or the spine rehab person because, you know, your doctor, and you're like, well, I think I'm okay now.
Everyone always waits until they're in really, really bad shape before they go see someone.
Yeah, it's always an emergency right before they see you. I'm wondering, Michael, what is C and T and L? Can you just break down for us what your doctor is going to tell you about where on the spine the problem is?
Sure. The vast majority of problems in the spine happen either in the cervical spine, which is the neck, or the lumbar spine, which is the low back. The thoracic spine, which is the part that's attached to all your ribs, doesn't move very much, and it's much less common to have problems in the thoracic spine. So it's either neck pain or pain shooting down the arm from the cervical spine, or pain in the low back, or possibly shooting down the legs from the lumbar spine. And then the very bottom of the spine is what's called the sacrum, going down to your coccyx, which people would call the tailbone, but that doesn't actually move. So it's pretty rare for there to be a problem there. So really the two main areas are cervical and lumbar. And that's what you're going to hear. I slipped a disc in my cervical spine or slipped a disc in the lumbar spine.
We have a slide of some common orthopedic or spine issues. I shouldn't say orthopedic, it's spine issues, right? So here's one that's talking about sprains and strains. But we've mentioned disc herniation and degenerative disc disease, stenosis, you know, and people also talk about whiplash, right? What is whiplash? Like people like, oh, I drove and I stopped short and the car hit me from behind. I have whiplash now. That's always a big TV thing, right? Like, gosh, I put the thing on, you know? So let's discuss whiplash, because I think it's probably more frequent than you realize when you're brought up short, but you guys know better than I do.
Whiplash is when it's usually with a car accident, but it could happen with any kind of accident where you have a swift jerk of your body, like a horseback riding accident or a boat, something colliding. But basically your body flings forward and then backwards. And then your muscles obviously are not happy with that injury, and they can kind of spasm or hyperreact to the trauma that you suffered. It's usually a musculoskeletal issue, meaning it's muscles and tissues that are just hyperinflamed and irritated. And sometimes you might not even have symptoms the day of the injury, and it might come a few days later or a few weeks later, more like a week. But it is something that a lot of people in car accidents do experience.
So we actually already have a question, a medical question from Gaurav Das, who says, I've been suffering from spondylolisthesis, which I have to tell you, if you have a tongue tie, it's a very hard word to say, since first grade. And I've been going through pain for years. What should I do? So maybe Michael will ask you, what is spondylolisthesis?
So it's a long word, but it's better just break it down into two words. The first part is spondy, which just basically refers to the spine. And listhesis means slip. So a spondylolisthesis is just a slippage of the spine. There's a few very common areas for that to happen. In younger people, and she said she was diagnosed really at quite a young age, often that's at the very bottom level at L5-S1, which is the very bottom disc of your spine. Where the spine really starts to connect with the sacrum and the pelvis. And there can actually be a little break in the bone, which sounds funny, but it's something we call called a pars defect. And that can happen just to anybody or, you know, for instance, in gymnasts, people are doing really aggressive extension or bending of their spine. And when those bones weaken there, the vertebra can slip. And that can cause a number of things. That can cause back pain because it's not as structurally sound as it should be, but also as Kimberly was saying, the nerves are in there, and when bones slip, they can pin the nerves in between the bones. So where there's supposed to be a nice big open space, when it collapses, the nerves can get pinched. So with the spondylolisthesis, you can have pain in your back and or pain radiating down the leg.
So what are the treatments that you can offer for that?
Well, maybe we'll start with what Kimberly can do. Which you would normally start with before, and then come back to talk about what I could do.
So guys, this is a great surgeon. This is exactly the right answer you should get.
I agree.
Go to a surgical consult.
Okay. All right. Good.
Conservative treatment first. So physical therapy, core strengthening exercises, learning what is appropriate for you to do and what activities are appropriate for you to avoid. That's a big thing when it comes to pain in general, is learning your body. And then you can try, you know, an epidural injection is something to consider for spondylolisthesis, to help calm down any nerve root inflammation that someone might have. And obviously there's medications and stuff, but a lot of patients now really don't like to take medications. And then if you've tried all of that and you're still really not feeling well, then I send you to Dr. Michael Smith.
So before we go to Michael, can we talk a little bit about what an epidural injection is?
Sure.
And what space? I have to tell you, when I got my first epidural for my first baby, I was like, oh, there's a space I've never felt before. It was very exciting. I'm a really weird pregnancy woman.
I think all of us doctors are. I freaked them out so much that they blew my IV and it was the worst.
mine for my kids did not take, it would take like a half yeah. side, not the
I
other.
I had to lay on my side for an hour, yes.
So how do you do it and where, what are you doing?
Yeah, we have a slide on that. Let's go back to that slide. There.
Okay. So an epidural is a very simple, easy procedure. It should not be traumatic or horribly painful. It basically is an injection where, as you see in the picture here, it goes through the layers in the skin and the fat and the ligaments into the epidural space. It is similar to what a pregnant woman gets, but it's a little different because when you're having an epidural as a pregnant woman, you're in labor, you're having contractions, you can't lay down on your stomach, and they're doing the injection blind. But when we do this injection for pain management, we use an X-ray or a fluoroscopy machine to guide where we're going, which makes it much, much easier to do, very precise, and much less painful and much more comfortable for the patient. So when we get to the epidural space, we inject a little bit of numbing medicine and fluid to wash away any inflammatory mediators in the area, and we put some steroids. And the steroids are what help to take away the inflammation that's causing the pain. The epidural will not fix the disc pathology, and it will not fix the spondylolisthesis, but it helps to take away the inflammation that's causing the pain.
You know, I want to back up a little bit because, you know, we had great questions. We already went like almost right to, you know, injections, to procedures, right? But when should someone actually be concerned about their back or their neck? Like, I'll tell you a story because I always make every show about me somehow. Suju and I take turns doing that, but you know, both of us have things. Like I, you know, just in the quiet of your bathroom, like when all of a sudden you're like drying your hair, you're just, you know, checking it from side to side, and you could hear this crunching that goes on in your neck. It's just been going on for 10 or 12 years. No, I've never seen anyone for it. Let's just put it there. But I did curbside my colleagues. I don't even sure if I found Mike and Michael, and I was like, hey, is it normal that like when I go like this and super quiet, I can hear crunching? And whoever it was I was talking to, they're like, yeah, you're at that age. Yes, it's normal. And I was like, okay. But so when should people, like, they're like, you know, I have this thing. Like, people will wait 10 years before they, like me, before they actually go see anybody. So when's the right time? Or what are the classic symptoms of, hey, you have a problem?
I'll run with that. So, you know, it's okay for the vast majority of things to not run in and see somebody, right? Because you're probably not going to want to start narcotics or start having Dr. Sackheim stick a needle in your spine or me do a surgery, right? Because there is a normal process. If you have the good fortune of living a long time in many decades, things are going to wear out, right? So just like your hips and your knees or your shoulders, your elbow can feel less smooth, or you feel like there's a grind or there's a pain. Same thing's happening in your spine, both with the discs that Kimberly was talking about, but also in the joints that run along the back. And so when you turn your neck, there's joints called facet joints, or some people say facet joints, that when they're not as smooth as they were when you were 20, you can hear a click or a pop or a grind. And that doesn't mean, you know, you're doing anything irresponsible by not running in to see a neurologist or, you know, a rehab doctor or a surgeon. So really, what are the things that should drive you to call, right? Either a neurologist or rehab doctor, surgeon. And there are things we call red flag symptoms, neurologic things, like if you have a new weakness, especially a severe weakness in your arm or your hand or your leg, what's called a foot drop. If you can't lift your foot up, you're tripping and stumbling, or you realize your leg is weak going up and down stairs, or the really big red flag things, things called like cauda equina syndrome, if you suddenly become incontinent. But most people are probably just on, you know, rational common sense going to run to the emergency room or call their doctor if they're suddenly incontinent. So those are really the extreme kind of scenarios. But so the things that you might not want to, maybe aren't red flag emergencies, but should lead you to getting evaluated, at least talk to your primary doc and see if you should see a non-operative or operative spine specialist. Really the more nerve type things, right? Pain, shooting down the arm, pain, numbness, tingling, shooting down the arm or leg, because that's probably when a nerve or maybe a spinal cord up in the neck is getting compromised. And that's more concerning than just, you know, I feel 10 years older than I was 10 years ago. Things are a little stiffer and more, you know, a little more snap, crackle, pop going on in the back of the neck.
I think that that's really good. And the red flags are really very important. I think that it's one thing to wait on simple things, but it's, you can't be waiting on, because red flag means if you don't get that treated right away, you can have permanent damage. Isn't that right?
Yeah, or a higher risk of not being able to recover, or more permanent long-term functional disability if you don't get to that as quickly as possible.
So getting back to spondylolisthesis, Gaurav said, so should I have surgery? Now, obviously, we're not going to give individual medical advice on this show, and you certainly, Gaurav, should see a specialist in your area. But Michael, what are the surgeries that you can do for a condition like spondylolisthesis?
Yeah, and let's go to the slide too, Julia, if we can.
Broadly speaking, there's two types of surgery. There's just what we call decompression surgery, which is a little simpler. So what's called a laminectomy, to just go in and take pressure off the nerve roots. And if it's a really small slippage, and it's what we call stable spondylolisthesis, sometimes you can get in and get the nerve decompressed by just taking out overgrown bone spur, ligament, those kind of things to make space for the nerve. The problem is, for a lot of spondylolisthesis, you actually need that big scary word, fusion, because the problem is it's unstable, or there's a degree of instability. And that's actually a little bit of a subtle thing, because it's not just stable, unstable. There's kind of gray areas in between. But if a level is unstable and that's why it's slipping, and you try to just take more stuff out there, you don't have to be a spine surgeon to realize that's probably not going to be a long-term durable solution. You have to actually stabilize that level. And those are screws and rods and cages and all the scary things that when people come in and say, well, you're not, you know, I don't want screws. And you're like, well, or the other doctor called them pins. They're not pins, they're screws. But what you have to do when a level is unstable and slipping is stabilize it. And that's fusion, which is very powerful surgery. It's just, it's a bigger surgery than just a laminectomy type surgery.
So let's talk a little bit about how we can preserve our spine, right? Like if there's someone like Gaurav who's lived with this now for many years, like it sounds like 20 years, you know, are there certain stretches and things that we can do to strengthen the spine? And in addition, Kater Ramanathan asked, what are good ways to stretch your back if one foot or leg is slightly smaller or larger? Does that mess up the alignment? I mean, I think we see this even with abdominal surgery, and I feel patients are splinting on one side and they're walking and they're carrying on. They're like, you know, I have a little pain here. And I'm like, yeah, but you're walking funny. And now you're complaining about pain on the other side. Like, it seems like, you know, their gait is changed. And so first ask Kater's question and then let's see what are some of the stretches and things that we can do.
Okay, so I guess I'll take this one. In general, whether you have pain or not, it's very important to do stretching and strengthening exercises. When our hamstrings and our quads and the muscles in our legs get tight, what happens is there's extra stress on our back in the normal activities that we do. So if your hamstrings are tight and you go to bend something, you're actually having more stress put on your lumbar spine and your lower back than somebody who is stretching their hamstrings every day. Another really important thing is core strengthening. So we live in flexion. We bend to lift things, we sit, we never do extension exercises. So we want to do extension exercises and we want to build our core so that when we do bend, we have some more stability in our abdomen to help support our spine while we're bending. What was the second part of that question?
Oh, if you are asymmetric and you're one length, yeah. And if there's like specific things that then you have to target, I would imagine.
Right. So most of us do have what is called a leg length discrepancy. That means that one of our legs is a little longer than the other one. And I would say if this is picked up early on, like as a pediatric patient, like when you're a child, it is important to maybe add a little lift to the bottom of your shoe or an insert into your shoe. Podiatrists make amazing custom-made lifts that you can use to keep your body aligned properly. If, unfortunately, this goes undiagnosed for in many people for years, and then when it's finally discovered, you can't just correct this much of a discrepancy all at once. Because as much as it's off and throwing your body off, if you correct it right at once, it is painful and uncomfortable. So if you do correct it, it's very important to correct it slowly by adding a teeny little bit at a time and just slowly letting your body get used to it. It also might not be comfortable to correct it if it's diagnosed later, but it can throw your body off. So it's something to look at closely, mostly in children. It's the best way to diagnose it and fix it.
We have some slides on some stretches that can be done for your back. And we just would love for you to kind of comment on. These seem like things that I'll do in like a core fusion class, like the hip crossover stretch to stretch out my hammies or my back. Yeah.
So this is a great stretch because it stretches all the gluteal muscles and especially the piriformis. And the piriformis, I'm sure everyone has heard, oh, I have piriformis syndrome. And piriformis is a muscle that can get really tight and isn't easy to stretch. So with this stretch, it gets that piriformis and it makes it so it doesn't get tight. And this is one I actually do often when I'm doing my stretches as well. So it's easy to do, even if you have back pain, this is a stretch that is easy to incorporate in your routine.
And this is one where you were talking about we live in flexion and not in extension, right?
Right. So this is a good one because it helps to get a little bit of extension in there, but it also works on your core strengthening. This one, you'll feel it in your stomach because it's working those abdominal muscles. But it's a really good one because a lot of patients with back pain cannot do sit-ups. Sit-ups, again, are flexion. And this is a way to work your core abdomens without flexing.
Yeah, I think that's important, you know, because people are always doing crunches because they've been told, like, it's great for your back. But a lot of times a crunch, you know, or a full sit-up, you're actually almost pulling out and not pulling in. So about plank, I'm not sure if that other slide had images of a plank and if that's helpful. And it's so funny, you know, in yoga, they call not cat camel, but they call it cat cow. So I'm not sure why this one says camel. But when I was looking for, you know, stretches and things like that, all the back stretches, they were not calling it cow. It's just funny to me.
If you look here at this slide, the bottom right is a full extension exercise, and that's a great one to do every day to make sure that you're getting some extension in your spine. And overall, none of these pictures have a flexion exercise. So it just shows how important it is to make sure you're doing exercises that don't just involve flexion.
Yeah, I have a chronic hamstring problem, and I can tell you, I keep stretching and it doesn't work. And piriformis, all those things.
Yeah, it's tough.
So how much time should people spend a day stretching? And what is the best time of day to do this kind of activity? Maybe Michael will go to that. And then Ellen does have a question about sciatica. So we'll go to your question next, Ellen.
I actually think Kimberly would probably be better to answer that in terms of, because you're really talking about this sort of, you know, what do you do non-operatively for health maintenance? I think the more important thing is to do it routinely, right? And you asked kind of earlier what, you know, what can you do about your back? There are other things too, right? Like not being obese is helpful. Not smoking is helpful, right? Because smoking is bad for a lot of things. It's bad for your connective tissues as well. Avoiding high stress, like bending, lifting, twisting, people moving their furniture or moving. Don't move your own stuff after you're, you know, after college or something. It's just such a classic way that people herniate disc, and that can start a cascade.
Moving is a big thing.
Yeah. So make sure somebody else does that for you. Assuming, not to be too blithe about, but if you have the resources that you can have somebody help you do it. That's something I...
Because the pandemic, people are moving so right. much, right? Like, so it's actually, this is a very timely thing to say. Moving is bad for your back.
Well, also in the pandemic, apparently, we all gained a COVID-25 COVID-19, right? They said 2 pounds a month average for a year. So, you know, and we're sitting around, we're doing Zoom calls, we're not commuting, we're not walking as much. So I think paying more attention to this is really very important in this time. Ellen Austin asks, what about sciatica? What can one do about sciatica?
You want Michael?
Yeah, well, I'll start with it. But first by saying, don't come to see me first generally, unless there's a red flag symptom, like, you know, you've got like a foot drop, or, you know, your foot's weak, really dense numbness, or absolutely uncontrolled pain. I mean, those are, you know, whether your primary doc's available to immediately assess you or go to the emergency room potentially if you're really in bad shape. Because we certainly can treat that surgically when it's bad enough. The majority of episodes of sciatica will get better without surgery because the body can actually heal, often with some of the magic that a non-operative specialist like Dr. Sackheim can do. And what maybe, Kimberly, do you want to talk about that first? And when that fails, come back to me. Or I'm sorry, if that fails, come back to me.
Whichever works best.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I see a question also, which specialty should I see if I have sciatica, which goes along with this. I would start, like Dr. Smith, like Michael said, with a pain management doctor or a rehab specialist, unless you're having severe red flags like numbness, weakness, or severe, horrible, disabling pain. Then you go straight to a surgeon. The initial question is, what do you do for sciatica? So sciatica is the pain that is in the back, the butt, going down the leg. And there are a lot of ways to treat it. And what you do depends on specifically for your goals. And there are very conservative ways, like just doing physical therapy and activity modification, and strengthening exercises, and maybe taking some anti-inflammatories and using ice. And then if things are a little worse, you can have an epidural. An epidural is a perfect thing to treat this type of pain. Some people want to go towards that sooner than others. There are medicines out there that I know people don't love to take medicines, but there are some very amazing medicines that are old and have been around forever. We know them well, like gabapentin, Neurontin. These are medicines that help to calm down nerve pain. And they are pretty safe if used appropriately. They are not addictive, and they can be very, very helpful to helping people get back to their normal activities. And then, God forbid, you try all of this and it doesn't help, then I would send to a surgeon.
And what might you do, Michael?
I don't know if we in our slide deck have a picture of a herniated disc just to pull up.
Yes, we do.
Because I think that's where a picture can be worth 1,000 words. So it, on this slide, when a disc herniates, it's usually pushing backward, as Kimberly said, where the nerves are. The nerves in the spinal cord are literally behind the disc, and it pinches or compresses. And the problem is, in that spinal canal, there is some space in there, but there's hard things like bones in the back. So when a disc herniates and there's a nerve in there, it pins the nerve between the mass of the disc herniation and the normal structures behind. And so often when those, what we call conservative or non-operative treatments, like rest, physical therapy, medications, injections, when they fail, in many cases, that's because the nerve is just severely physically compromised and you're not going to get better. And so you can just keep suffering, because eventually many will get better, but that may take months or even years, or you have the option of surgery. Now, one of the nice things about surgery for herniated disc versus what we were talking about for spondylolisthesis is they tend to be quite small surgeries, actually minimally invasive or microscope surgeries. So through an incision that long, 1 hour surgery, usually done in a ambulatory day surgery kind of setting, not needing to be in the hospital, you can do a microdiscectomy. So you make a little window in the bone to get into the spinal canal, take out that fragment of disc, make sure the nerve's decompressed and close. And then you go home, you take it easy for a few weeks, then you can do some rehabbing over the next couple, several weeks. And so that by, people say different things. I would usually say about by 3 months after a discectomy surgery, you can essentially resume full normal activity, but you want to resume exercise and activity in a progressive way while you're letting the area heal. And while surgery has the downside of being scary and it's anesthesia and surgery, has the upside of being the one intervention that immediately decompresses a nerve. And there are a lot of patients who are in bad pain in the pre-op holding area who in the what we call the PACU or recovery room, even though their back hurts, they say, oh God, my leg doesn't hurt for the first time in 4 weeks or whatever it is. So they can feel that change right away. Now, sometimes it can take a little longer for more complete nerve healing, especially if there's numbness or weakness, because the nerve actually has to heal. And that can take weeks or actually months. Also depends on how long the nerve was compressed before. So there's this problem here, right? Because we keep saying, well, if you wait too long, it's bad. But you also don't want to jump in too early. And that's where you need guidance, maybe from your primary doctor, if he or she feels comfortable giving guidance, or certainly from, you know, like Kimberly to say, no, this is something I think you're going to get better with some, you know, care, or versus this is more concerning and it'd be better to get that nerve decompressed as soon as possible.
I want to go back to that slide on the spine, and it talks about all the different things that can happen to your discs. The reason I want to talk about that is just because, hello, I've lost some height since, you know, age 40, and I'm not happy about it. One, you know, it's, I think it's because my disc, my vertebra have compressed, right? But what is actually happening when people lose height? My favorite is my dad keeps going on about how he's 5'11".
Listen, I was 5'4 and a quarter for a very long time, and yeah. I don't even make that quarter.
I still carry myself like I'm 5'6½", but I've not. I've lost at least almost an inch. So what's happening when we are losing height? Is it a disc thing or is it just a compression thing? Well, we're going to get to the vertebral column disorders, but that other slide really talks about degenerative disc and compression and things like that. And that was what we are asking about.
It could be a combination of degenerative disc issues or compression. In this slide, everything below normal disc can have you lose height. So the discs are kind of like a jelly donut, like a plump hamburger, and they're full of fluid and tissue. And as time goes by, we lose the fluid in the discs. The little fibers break or tear. Sometimes the jelly comes out of the donut and the disc gets flatter and it's not as plump. And what keeps those bones separated and heightened is that plump disc. So when that disc is smaller or degenerated or bulging or herniated, the bones get closer together and we actually can lose height. And if you have that at multiple levels, you'll see the height loss more significantly than if you have it only at one level. And then like a vertebral compression fracture is a totally separate thing where the actual bone is smaller because it's compressed and you can lose height that way as well.
Rhea Coyne has a great question. She just had a CAT scan and got a diagnosis of multi-level discogenic degenerative changes of the visualized spine. Yeah, I know.
Sounds like Studio 54 all over again.
What is that? And she's asking what she should do.
And we don't know her age, I guess, but that's actually fairly.
Rhea and I went to high school together, so 21.
Okay, great. So that's pretty unusual at 21. But if she happened to be in her 50s or 60s or 70s for sure, you know, that's actually not uncommon. As Kimberly was talking about, when you lose a little bit of that, the health of the hydration of each of those discs, so you see the loss of height, you get little bone spurs forming, disc bulges. Those are all together under that, for the radiologist to say multi-level degenerative, discogenic degenerative changes. And again, it's abnormal because it's not the normal state in youth, but it's normal with time, with aging. It's wear and tear, it's arthritis. And you don't necessarily have to do anything about it because I can see a 70-year-old who's in my office for a tumor, who's got severe multi-level degenerative changes, never had a day of back or leg pain in his or her life. And so you can actually degenerate over time, not have a major problem with it, not really need to do anything about it. But if you do have back pain, then that can get tricky, especially multi-level disease, because that's not a good target for surgery, or we just have to put screws all the way up and down, which most people don't want. Those are really big surgeries.
And important to know as a patient is Michael and I get MRIs on patients all day long. I do not remember the last time I saw a normal MRI. So most people have something on their MRI, degenerative disc disease, a disc bulge, and this is whether they have pain or not. So it's more important to treat your symptoms than treat what you're actually seeing on the MRI.
So that's a great point.
Yeah. As you see, we have people watching in and weighing in from all over the world, and we're really grateful to both of you for being here. We've been talking about some of the things that happen as we age, but one of my favorite authors, Judy Blume, wrote a book called Deanie that I read, 100 years ago, 21 minus 100, so I must have been 12, about a book called Deanie, about a girl who was born with severe scoliosis of the spine. So her spine curvature was wrong. And back then, she had to wear an external brace. So maybe we can start with you, Kimberly, and ask what do we do? How do we make a diagnosis of a spinal anatomical defect like that? And then what do we do about it nowadays?
So I can answer a little bit on this, but Michael's definitely going to give you a more detailed answer. This is, if it's very severe, you can see the curvature abnormality in somebody's spine. It can be specifically diagnosed with X-ray or CAT scan, where it shows you the bones and they can measure the angles and see how severe it is. They still do some external bracing, but if things are really severe, and I mean, this can affect your lungs, your breathing ability, your nerves. And in that case, you would be sent to a neurosurgeon. And that's to prevent further curvature from developing, and also to help with these neurological or respiratory issues that someone can have.
So the graphic that we showed, Michael, shows sort of a normal spine from the back and from the side, and then the S-shaped scoliosis curvature, the sort of hump-like of a lordosis, and then what's called a kyphosis. Can you tell us about those things?
Yeah, let's run through that. The scoliosis is a curvature if you're looking from somebody front to back. And if, say, you have especially like a thin sort of young teenage girl, which is probably the most common, it's more common in girls than boys, adolescent scoliosis, which is different than adult scoliosis. Especially if they had their shirt off, you might be able to see like that one shoulder blade is sticking out more than the other shoulder blade because of that curvature. As Kimberly was saying, that can just be monitored. There's a lot of people who have some scoliosis, but if it's a 15 degree scoliosis, they're just going to get an X-ray for a few years, because once you get to a skeletal maturity at 19 or 20 and you stop growing, most of these curvatures stabilize and you never need surgery, and you can live your whole life with a little bit of scoliosis and live a normal exercising active life. But the problem is, especially when, either in the younger group, which is even more challenging and sometimes or often in kids with genetic disorders, but in perfectly otherwise healthy adolescent, as more commonly girls again, as they're going through the growth spurt, the spine doesn't spurt up straight, the curves get worse. And that's where surgery, and there are newer non-fusion techniques and more traditional fusion techniques to basically slow that curvature, reverse the curvature. With fusion, it's more powerful. You can actually make that perfectly straight again. The non-fusion techniques are putting like a tension on it to basically put a force against the curvature to help you grow straighter. And then in the adults, it's a little bit of a different process. It's more from the degeneration. And if a disc doesn't just settle like this, it settles like this. And the one above it settles like that. That's how adults can get scoliosis. If we can go back to that slide, the totally different problem, another problem that we see more in adults, especially in the later decades, is kyphosis. And if you sort of think of a, not to stereotype, but like a picture of like a you know, an elderly person who's a little bit hunched forward, that's kyphosis. So kyphosis means leaning forward, and it's normal to be kyphotic in your thoracic spine. You can see that on the normal spine. But when that becomes exaggerated, it becomes harder to hold your head up. When it's more severe, it's harder to actually look forward. So you're walking down the street, you know, you're fighting, your muscles are fighting to hold yourself up. It's exhausting.
I want to bring out something, though. It's just, you know, when I look at those pictures, I think of all of my older surgeon colleagues who did open surgery forever. And they're all kind of like, you know, when, even when they're walking, they're like just a little bit forward. And I actually, you know, frequent the chiropractor, and they're like, do you look at your phone a lot? I'm like, yeah, all the time. And I'm wondering if this is something you guys are seeing more of now, because we're all like this. And except for Sri, our executive producer, he does this thing. He's like, I know it looks weird, but I always walk around like this with my phone up here. And I'm like, well, you're going to have great biceps and delts by the time that's all done.
And cervical musculature for that. That's actually a good thing. We are seeing a lot of new issues from texting and leaning forward and sitting at a desk all day. It's definitely new things. Like I said, extension, even your neck, it needs extension.
But technology is actually advancing, right? So, Michael, we have a slide of some, I thought it was really kind of nice. Like, you used to, for neck issues, do fusion, as you said, but now there's like disc replacement, and you're thinking, wow, that's kind of cool. So we have a slide of that, if you can just kind of talk about that.
So let's say you have a herniated disc in your neck and you've got a pretty healthy disc. So this can happen. You actually, the disc isn't totally collapsed, but a fragment of disc herniates, is pushing the nerve. You've got severe arm pain that doesn't get better with a few weeks of physical therapy and some, you know, maybe an epidural. The traditional treatment, as you can see on the right side of the screen, is taking out that disc and putting in bone graft and what's called a cage and a plate. And that's very effective and very powerful. But the problem with stiffening one segment of the spine, it puts more stress at the level above or below. And it's amazing to me how many patients know about this when, by the time they come into my office, and if we start discussing fusion, they already know that there's thing about that next level. They may not know the term adjacent segment disease, but that's the problem. And about, if you do a fusion at one level, there's about a 20% chance that within 10 years, you'll need a surgery at the level above or below. So the idea of trying to do motion preserving surgery, like with artificial discs, is it's not so much that you can move your head around a lot more after an artificial disc versus a fusion. Actually, you wouldn't really be able to notice that in real life. It's really about not changing the biomechanics of the spine, not putting that extra stress in the level above and below to not be as at that same risk of needing surgery at the next level in the future, or to be at a lower risk. And so that was one specific company's implant, but there's, well, around the world, there's probably dozens, but there's three or four artificial discs that we can use in the cervical spine. They're more effective for the cervical spine at this point than the lumbar spine, although those exist too, but those are a little bit, they haven't been quite as successful, but the cervical spine artificial disc can be a great option, especially for somebody in their 30s, 40s, 50s, where you really want to maintain motion.
Yeah, I want to still be able to nod, like, you know, we're Indian, we always doing something with our heads. So it's like, yeah, okay. You know, you want to be able to nod and have that mobility. I have colleagues who are very, like, had their neck fused early, and you could see how it affected them and what their mobility was.
Yeah.
You know, we have a couple of very interesting questions from our audience. Joshi Sparrow says they had a 3-level TLIF surgery, terrific outcome, but now they find it difficult to perform any activity which involves bending. So they're pain-free. And I think this speaks to a couple of issues. One is, don't go to the surgeon first. The second is, after surgery, you may still need care. And maybe, Kimberly, you can talk to us about post-operative care how people can maximize their outcome so they don't stiffen up like that.
Right. So once you're out of surgery and the surgeon has given you the okay to do, you know, regular therapy that is not restricted, it's important to do physical therapy. And just like not every doctor is the same, not every physical therapist is the same. And it's really important to have an amazing physical therapist. A good physical therapist is someone who is doing exercises with you the majority of your session. I know everyone loves to have a massage and everyone loves to have Biofreeze rubbed on them and their little TENS unit with the electrical. And that's all great. But a really good therapist is going to be doing activities and exercises with you. And that's really important because when you have a fusion and that area is stiff and really the mobility is decreased, the most important thing is to keep the muscles around that area healthy and as limber as possible. Obviously, you don't want to hurt that fusion, but a good physical therapist is key in this.
You know, we have a question about how do you prevent kyphosis? And I think you touched on it a bit in terms of the stretching and the exercises. Michael, do you have anything more to say other than, you know, I know in surgery, we're all talking about ergonomics and not leaning forward like we used to do. Anything a non-surgeon can do to prevent kyphosis?
So I think the two big pictures there are one, the musculature and being aware of good posture, doing the, keeping the extensor muscles strong. Sometimes it's just aging and degenerative changes and people going forward over time. But certainly being aware of your posture, being, you know, not hunching over your phone all day, or like I use a microscope to operate so I can stand like this instead of leaning forward all the time during surgery. Another big important thing are your bones, and especially for women and East Asian and Caucasian women, the risk of osteoporosis, because that really severe kyphosis you'll see sometimes in older people can be from multi-level vertebral compression fractures, which is absolutely debilitating. So when, I don't know the exact age, but in your 50s, you should get a bone density test. If you have declining bone densities, osteopenia, before, preferably to catch it before osteoporosis, it's a silent disease, but it can be a killer. And you really should see your primary doctor or even be referred to a specialist for treatment for osteopenia or especially osteoporosis, because that kind of kyphosis, it's essentially untreatable once you have multiple levels of your spine broken.
Yeah, we have one more question before we get to the end. Unfortunately, we could talk to you guys forever, but we do have a question about whether deadlifts and squats are bad for your back. Manish Kumar says, what strength training exercises do you recommend to strengthen the whole upper and lower back? And maybe Kimberly will ask
you
that.
Say no to deadlifts.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you how many people I have had in my office literally just because they had an acute herniated disc with severe pain from doing a deadlift.
Do you know, this is a whole CrossFit generation we're talking to, and they're doing a lot of leg lifts and they're doing kettlebells and all these things. And
a lot of it is okay as long as you're strong enough to do it. But deadlifts, I'm not a fan of deadlifts.
Wait, can we just to shock our viewers, and actually it's a little bloody picture. I want to just, you know, deadlifts, and then you end up with the spine fixation. We have a couple of images that we want Michael to talk about.
That is exactly what happens if you do powerlifting as an adult. I would go beyond deadlifts and clean and jerks, all the powerlifting stuff. It's just, you're asking to end up with a bunch of screws and rods in your back. There's a lot of great ways to stay fit as an adult. Yeah. Powerlifting, not the solution.
So we are running out of time. So if you guys could give us each one takeaway, that'd be great. Something to tell our viewers and our listeners to watch out for or to preserve their health. Kimberly?
I would say be your own health advocate. Don't just believe everything that everybody says and don't just jump into treatment. Ask questions. Make sure it's the right treatment for you. Do your research and don't wait until your pain is severe before seeking out help.
And Michael?
I would say don't smoke. Try not to be obese. Stay fit and active. And you can do lots of fun things, run all kinds of stuff, play tennis, but do something for your core as well, whether you want to do that self-directed on your own or with a Pilates studio type scenario, to maintain the strength and flexibility of your core.
That's great.
Thank you both so much. We really appreciate you being here. You've really engaged us and the audience. You guys, if somebody missed it or you want someone to watch it, you can always find us on YouTube at She's On Call. We are carried on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and WBAI.org on Mondays from 2 to 3 p.m. So please tune in. And next week is Easter Sunday. So Marina.
Yeah, we're taking off that weekend, but we have a great show replay. It's our leaders, women leaders in surgery. We have the two deans, Dr. Dean Bradford, Carol Bradford, who is at the Ohio State Medical College, and she's also president of the AAOHNS. No chance I'm going to say that. Always mess it up. And then Dr. Julie Freischlag. So they were on our show a few weeks ago. She's the Dean and CEO of Wake Forest Medical Center and Medical School, and also the President-elect of the American College of Surgeons. So sadly, this week has come to a close. We do want to give a great shout out to our producers who have done such a wonderful job. This show couldn't happen without them. And if you guys are interested, just, retweet this, because we are going to be back on YouTube again, and you can watch the show again if you're interested.
Thanks, and stay safe, everyone.